From Texas to Virginia, Nevada to Massachusetts, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Green New Deal promises a socialist paradise, but it's not even remotely realistic. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College is here to discuss. Bernie Sanders is the latest entry into what is becoming a crowded field of contenders for the 2020 Democrat presidential nomination. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story on the party's tilt to the left. Efforts to impose unconstitutional campaign finance laws continue to percolate through Congress. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Stephen Greenhut of R Street. And an often overlooked reason why the nation needs a wall at its southern border is the ongoing threat of terrorism. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why the threat is real on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Green New Deal wants to eliminate everything from air travel to cow flatulence, and it promises a minimum income to everyone, whether you're willing to work or not. But is any of this realistic? Dr. Paul Kengor is with the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. He's familiar to our listeners as a regular commentator and joins us now to talk about the Green New Deal. Paul, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Paul, we have members of Congress in the House and Senate who have introduced something called the Green New Deal. And this is sort of the progressives' holy grail of what a socialist America would look like. But for those in our audience who may not be familiar with the proposal, tell us a little bit about what they are proposing to do.
Well, I'll tell you, Loman, it's really a very radical piece of legislation and very radical roots. And the piece I wrote on this called the Green-Red Deal for the American Spectator, I wanted people to have a sense of the roots, the socialistic roots, because people don't realize, we have a phrase, right, follow the money to find out the origins of something. But when it comes to some of this stuff on the political left, you've got to follow the roots of the ideology. This stuff doesn't just appear out of nowhere. But it was announced recently, last week before, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's 29 years old. She was elected to Congress as a 28-year-old from New York, and she is a literal democratic socialist. She ran on the Democratic Party ticket, but she's a formal member of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, which if you go to their website, they refer to themselves as America's largest socialist organization. In fact, the exact language is the largest socialist organization in the United States. So, right then and there, a lot of people, Loman, defenders, right, they'll say, well, it's not socialism, it's democratic socialism. Well, tell that to the DSA, which calls itself socialist. But her Green New Deal, which is supposed to be a piece of environmental legislation that says, among other things, and this is directly from her talking points, Ocasio-Cortez's talking points, quote, build out high-speed rail at a scale where air travel stops becoming necessary. I mean, that's amazing to think about. Another statement, upgrade or replace every building in U.S. for state-of-the-art energy efficiency. I want people to just stop and think about this, right? Upgrade or replace every building in the U.S. She didn't say buildings that need to be replaced, right? Or buildings that are lacking energy efficiency. No, every building in the United States. And how big of a deal is this? Well, like she said, quote, national, social, industrial, and economic mobilization at a scale not seen since World War II. A 10-year plan to mobilize every aspect of American society, exact quote, at a scale not seen since World War II to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a very radical idea.
It's so radical. It sounds like something straight out of the old Soviet Union. As a matter of fact, you had a great analogy involving a watermelon to explain this.
Yeah, that's right. The old phrase, watermelons, they are green on the outside, red on the inside. And you know, leftist environmentalists, they hate that. But then they go and they push things like this, right? And the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970, occurred on the centenary of Lenin's birth. Every Earth Day is Vladimir Lenin's birthday. And old communists from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, they went into the environmental movement. Now, this doesn't mean that every environmentalist is a commie, right? I mean, I consider myself, Loman, an environmentalist. But what's happened is a lot of communists and socialists have flocked to the environmental movement because that gives them a chance to control people and resources. It lets them manage, and it allows them to central plan, which is what central planners do. So for a lot of these old socialists and Marxists and communists, the environmental movement has been the perfect haven for them to go and manage people and resources.
Does this also not, Paul, stray into the redistributionist strain of democratic socialism in terms of what it would do to guarantee people incomes, whether they work or not? That was one of the big takeaways after this came out. Was that, in fact, part of this plan?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, an earlier plan way back in 1848 in the Communist Manifesto, point number 9 in Marx and Engels' 10-point plan, talks about a, quote, more equitable distribution of the population across the country. It talked about equally distributing not just the property of people, but people themselves and where people live. And if you've ever seen the movie The Killing Fields in Cambodia, that awful scene when people are being evacuated out of the capital city into the countryside, of course, that also took place in Mao's China as well, and other communist countries. So they really want to redistribute not just property, not just money, not just, you know, resources, but people as well. So for the environmental movement to try to be able to control people, how they're located, how they move, how they're mobilized, it's a Marxist dream. And this idea of building high-speed rail at, quote, a scale where air travel stops becoming necessary, that's madness. You're going to ban airplanes? How are you going to get from the Pacific Coast to Asia? You're going to run an Amtrak rail from Los Angeles to Australia? How are you going to do something like that? You could invent Star Trek teletransporters before you could do something like that. To borrow another phrase from communist Marxist thought, it's utopian. The Greek origin of utopia is otopos, which means no place. You can't actually create utopia. Utopia is in the next world. Heaven, we call it, right? It's not in this world. So it's really unrealistic from the outset. And I think for Ocasio-Cortez, this ought to be considered a career killer. Because this is silly.
We have been talking with Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Paul, tell us a little bit about Grove City College. Also, you've written a number of books, many of which are right on point to this topic. So let folks know where they can go to get those books.
Amazon.com. I have a book called Dupes. I have another, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. I wrote A Pope and a President on Ronald Reagan, John Paul II. So you can find all those on Amazon, maybe your local bookstore. And I teach at Grove City College, which is one of the very few colleges in the country where you're not going to get this kind of Green New Dealish socialist brainwashing. You know, we actually teach that socialism is bad. We teach the virtue of free markets. We teach what the founders believed.
We have again been talking with Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City. Paul, we appreciate all your commentaries on American Radio Journal, and thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Loman, and American Radio Journal. I'm proud to be part of it. It's a great program. Thanks for all you do.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. And Scott, Congress is not in session this week, but a whole lot happened last week. So let's talk a bit about that. We did finally have a resolution that prevented a second government shutdown. So want to do a recap for us?
It did prevent the government shutdown, but let's talk about the process behind what happened last week. First of all, Members were given the Consolidated Appropriations Act, 1,169-page bill, and guess what? Big shocker, they were given less than 24 hours to read it before they got to vote on it. It wasn't available to the American people. It wasn't available to members of Congress for even a day before we're voting on such a large spending bill. Nonetheless, it passed with over 300 votes. There's confidence for you in making sure that we keep our government open. But process aside, there were other issues with the legislation that we had concerns about. Let's talk about one thing. We passed $22 trillion in the national debt last week, and then we go ahead and pass this big Consolidated Appropriations Act. It did nothing to address our debt and deficit issue, and so the Club for Growth issued a key vote alert to the members of Congress in urging them to oppose the legislation. We did have a lot of really solid conservative members that stood up for fiscal sanity and opposed the legislation, but nonetheless, it did pass, and it also included $1.7 billion of border money for the president, and that money is going to be able to spend right away now that it's signed into law. But in addition to that, President Trump issued an emergency declaration freeing up even more money to allow for the Trump border wall to begin construction. In the interim period over the last several days, the House Democrats are preparing a resolution of disapproval against President Trump's emergency declaration. And meanwhile, we have 16 state attorneys general that have filed a lawsuit claiming that there would be a negative environmental impact if the border wall construction were allowed to proceed. So that's sort of the status on appropriations and the president's emergency declaration related to the border fight. We've also had a situation here where members of Congress are back at home right now and they have an opportunity to hear from constituents. So hopefully your listeners are calling in and going to town halls and making sure that their voice is heard to members.
This is certainly the time to do that because, as you just mentioned, Scott, when Congress does come back into session, there is that resolution against the president and his invocation of executive powers to build the wall. Even if Congress does pass a resolution, does that have any binding effect on the president at all, or can he just simply disregard it?
What he'll do is he'll veto it, and then if Congress had enough votes to override the veto, it really could slow down the process. But I think that would be a pretty steep hill to climb.
Certainly, this is going to be an ongoing fight over the next, well, probably years, as you mentioned, with all the lawsuits, and all of which were entirely predictable. And we, of course, will watch as we slog our way through that. Scott, all of this is prelude and part of the ramp up for the 2020 presidential election. Of course, President Trump did promise the border wall as a central part of his campaign in 2016, so he will continue to pursue that. A large number of Democrats are entering this presidential fray, and a big name got into it this past week. Who's now, again, a candidate for president?
Yeah, everybody's favorite socialist, Bernie Sanders, has gotten back in the presidential race. The interesting thing about Senator Sanders is he actually has the largest following of online donors, and Beto O'Rourke is second. But that's, I think, really indicative of the size of the revolution that he has built from the 2016 election and now going into 2020. Certainly, 2020 election is kicked off and in full gear at this point. We've seen various candidates traveling to the early states and beginning to make their case. There have been some pretty long lines in South Carolina and Iowa and New Hampshire. So it'll be interesting to see who's really able to grab some momentum and make a unique case for their party's nomination. I'm particularly interested to see how the presidential field reacts to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal and what that means in terms of policy. You know, a lot of Democrats in Congress just want to give the American people as many free things as they can. But what happens when you give free things? There's a cost somewhere, and our debt and deficit continues to grow and grow and grow. The Green New Deal is something that really could impact every corner of our nation's economy and have real negative effects when it comes to economic output, productivity, jobs, wages, the markets, no doubt about it. So we're certainly paying attention to see how folks will either distance themselves or come out and make a big pivot to the left and endorse them.
As we look at this presidential race and it's taking shape here, Scott, are the Democrats with this Green New Deal headed in a direction where they're going to end up so far on the left fringe, whoever their nominee is, isn't going to have the ability to get back anywhere toward the middle to get the votes that are needed to win a general election?
That's something that you always have to do when you're trying to win a general election. You have to appeal to moderate voters and independent voters and even Republican voters that are disenfranchised by their own nominee. I'm not sure that any of the Democrat field is going to show their cards and how they would move to the middle if they were the nominee at this point, because that'll show how they don't really have authenticity related to their own campaign. But that's typical politicians. They say one thing, they make promises on the campaign, and then they're unable to fulfill them when they get elected.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club, also where folks can go online to read about the issues we've discussed today and many others for that matter.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually join our organization for free. I'd also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Democrats in Congress continued to push for free speech restrictions in the form of new campaign finance laws. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out why this is unconstitutional from Stephen Greenhut of R Street. Eric?
Well, I always like to say that you can't get the money out of government until you get the government out of people's money. But that, of course, doesn't stop politicians from trying. And sure enough, the Democrats in Congress are now putting forward another proposal that attempts to crack down on Americans' First Amendment rights to spend money on political campaigns and other things as well. And that is what we are going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Steve Greenhut. He's a former boss of mine, actually, back when Watchdog.org was still around and still kicking. These days, he's the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute, and he is a syndicated columnist for the Orange County Register, the American Spectator, and a bunch of other publications, too. Steve, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thanks so much.
Steve, your column this week, the column that's running on our website this week at Reason.com, is all about this new proposal that some Democrats in Congress are pushing. It's House Resolution 1. You may have seen Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez grandstanding about this in a committee hearing about a week ago. This is going to be the thing that saves our democracy, Steve. This is going to clean up all that dirty, dirty money that's polluting everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has no chance of passage, obviously, with Donald Trump as president and with the Republicans controlling the Senate. But I think the Democrats feel as if it's a rallying cry. You know, it's described as a sweeping anti-corruption measures and stamping out the influence of money in politics. That's how Vox described it. And of course, you can't get politics out of politics, right? I mean, that's the whole thing, is we have this massive government. And people who are most affected by that government are going to spend money. There's offensive spending, which is offensive often, but it's to get things. If you're a crony capitalist or in many cases governments lobby other governments to get diversions of funding. And then there are businesses that spend money to stop bad things from happening to them. So the issue is that you have so much power in government and so much money in the size of government that of course people are gonna spend money to influence it one way or the other, no matter what new rules you put in. And a lot of the new rules that have been imposed over the years just keep making things worse, because there are all sorts of workarounds. I mean, money in politics is like water rolling down a hill. It's going to find its way to the bottom eventually.
That's a good point. We put these caps on campaign contributions years ago, and maybe that seemed like a good idea. But all that really did is it just pushed a lot of that spending into these PACs and super PACs, and a lot of times those are more difficult to track, more difficult to find out where the money is actually coming from, if that's something you're concerned about. And the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, they said that you can't get money out of politics. They're not talking about this as a practical matter, but rather as a constitutional matter. That is, they say that it is literally unconstitutional to use laws to stop people from spending their money on politics if that's what they want. That was the basis of the famous Citizens United decision and a few other important decisions in the 2000s. Steve, how does that factor into this debate over these new campaign finance laws in Congress?
Yeah, the Democrats have Citizens United. To them, it's just all they have to do is drop that term, and that's, ooh, the boogeyman. But yeah, we do have this weird little thing called the First Amendment, and you can't, referring to Will again, he talked about what if you tried to control the New York Times on what they print, not by saying they can't print anything, but by saying they can only spend a certain amount of money on journalists, paper, ink, printing presses, delivery trucks, and so forth. So in other words, the giving itself maybe isn't a First Amendment issue, but it allows, or the money is what's necessary to get the message out. And here in California, it's such a big state, and if you're going to influence, let's say, a statewide initiative, you need a lot of money to do that. I mean, I can rant and rail against things in a newspaper column, but if you're going to actually try to stop something, you need so many millions of dollars. So when you control the spending, you end up controlling people's ability to express their First Amendment rights. And I point out, too, that conservatives have been railing against this to a degree, too. Everyone has their own boogeyman billionaires to fulminate against.
Sure. The right gets upset at George Soros and the Tom Steyers, those types of guys. And, in the same way, well, maybe not in the exact same way, but in a similar way to how the left talks about other billionaires spending their money on politics. Right now, we are talking to Steve Greenhut. He is the regional director for the R Street Institute and a regular columnist for a number of publications in California and across the country. Steve, just about a minute left here. I want to leave off on this. Whether we're talking about demonizing billionaires or controlling political speech with campaign finance laws, it seems like some of that is missing the point. Shouldn't we be expecting our elected officials, once they're in office, to really put aside some of these questions of where the money is coming from, who wrote them a big check, and really focus on the things that matter for the country as a whole? Maybe I'm naive. I might be asking for too much. I probably am, to think that that's what should happen.
Oh, probably. I mean, I don't know. A lot of the money goes to people. I think a lot of lobbyists support officials who already basically agree with them, right? The bottom line is the problem is that government is so big and so costly and has so much impact on our lives and our businesses that that's the problem. It's government. In the ideal world, in our ideal libertarian world, the government would be so small that it really wouldn't matter who controlled it, but it's so big that it does matter. So, of course, people are going to spend a lot of money, and a lot of things that happen are not going to be very pleasant. I agree with that.
And I guess that brings us right back to where we started. You're not going to get the money out of politics until you get the politics out of money. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon either. And we are out of time for today. So, Steve Greenhut, thanks for being here and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you.
And again, that is Steve Greenhut. He is a syndicated columnist for us at Reason.com, as well as the Orange County Register, the American Spectator, and others. He's also the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute. You can check out their work at rstreet.org. And we appreciate Steve being here on the show today. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm, and you can catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The terrorist insurgency that executed the September 11th, 2001 attacks on our nation is still alive and well, and a key reason why we need to improve our security at our southern border. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There's a continuing battle brewing between liberals and President Trump over the border wall with Mexico. The government was even shut down for almost 35 days in one of the longest shutdowns ever over funding for the border wall. In early February 2019, a budget deal was struck to avert another shutdown despite insufficient funding for the wall. President Trump responded by declaring a national emergency to get the funding. it was the right decision. Have we learned nothing in the 17 years since the September 11, 2001 attack on the United States? The September 11th Commission report describes in detail the new form of terrorism in the world. We have all now experienced it firsthand. In the September 11th Commission report, Chapter 3 describes the new evolution of counterterrorism, and Chapter 13 provides a blueprint for dealing with the new threat. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are ignoring that threat just as the threats were ignored prior to the horrific attack on the United States in 2001. This blueprint from the Commission for dealing with the new threat includes things such as the unity of effort across the foreign and domestic divide, the unity of effort in the intelligence community. It expects a unity of effort in sharing information. And imagine this, a unity of effort in Congress, as well as organizing America's defenses in the United States. I've spent the vast majority of my adult life in the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps Reserve. I retired as a colonel and served in the United States Central Command, Joint Forces Special Operations Command, briefly in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Most of the experience in the latter part of my career was in counterinsurgencies and insurgencies. It is nothing short of naive for Congress, particularly the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader of the Senate, to not understand that an exposed southern border with absolutely no substantive controls is a fertile ground for a determined enemy. To expose the United States and our citizens to such a porous border is negligent. We did not know better in 2001, and perhaps we should have, but we know better now. We've had 17 years to deal with this crisis, and we should have learned by now that our operational seams are what puts us in the world's most vulnerable position nationally. Controlling who comes into and goes out of our nation is critical for the blueprint of dealing with the new threat. For some reason, congressional members seem intent to just do that. This border wall and controlling our southern flank not only makes sense, but we should be questioning and investigating why it has not happened before. Our nation in 2019 is tired from being at war. Our armed forces are weary and need to be rebuilt. The enemy has been dramatically reduced, but it is still vibrant in so many ways that only insurgencies can do. Insurgencies are very difficult to defeat. There's no end of the war in an insurgency, no welcome home parades. The insurgency either withers and dies, or we do. Our nation slept comfortably in the cloak of complacency until that fateful day in September 2001, and we are in danger of doing that again in 2019 with the battle over the border wall between Mexico and the United States. The September 11th Commission report's blueprint should remind us that our failures of a unity of effort in the intelligence community with the fracture and politicization of some of the intelligence community and the lack of unity of effort in Congress in combining to undermine the Organization for the America's Defenses within the United States. Build the wall. Terrorism is aimed at Americans, not just our government, but the very fabric of our society. The desperation of terrorist networks comes from our military success on the battlefield, as well as the successes of the local police forces, the FBI, CIA, NSA, as well as our allies at keeping terrorists on the defensive. We must be ever more vigilant today than since September 2001. The typical tactics for terrorists in this situation they find themselves in today is to strike hard at their enemy, the free world. In order to bolster the morale of their terrorists, they must either strike or risk losing the psychological war that we are fighting against them. Patience, persistence, vigilance, and border security are the keys to victory in this war. The men and women in uniform and our citizens are counting on us. Build the wall. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYYC-AM in York, Pennsylvania, WIJD-AM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WNVY-AM in Pensacola, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.